why don't we go ahead and get started with a few announcements while people join us. Thank you, everybody, for being on the call today. I'm really, really excited for today's call. It's promoting disability pride, exploring the evolution of disability culture. And we're really lucky to have Stephen Brown with us today. So just a little bit of housekeeping before we get started. There is a PowerPoint for today's presentation, and if you'd like to access it, it's on our website. So April, www.april-rural.org, and it's right on the home page there. From that page, you can also access our CART. So the CART link will be going on throughout today's call. And following today's call, we will have a transcript as well as a audio recording available on our website so that you can access it later. So let's see. We're going to try to do things a little bit differently today. So we have a new system. So I'm going to have everybody on mute until we get to questions and answers. And then at that point, if you have a question, go ahead and push *6, and that will unmute yourself, and I'll see your line pop up. So again, if you push *6, that's how you can go ahead and unmute yourself and ask your question at that time. And we'll stop periodically throughout the call for questions because this really, we're hoping, is more of a conversation rather than a presentation. And along with those lines, you can also ask questions using the CART system. And I do have it pulled up here, so if you have a question and type it in, I will, you know, go ahead and read that question for you, and then we'll go about it that way. And so for today we have Steve, and I just want to read a little bit about him. So Stephen Brown is the co-founder of the Institute on Disability Culture, and a retired professor and disability scholar at the Center on Disability Studies in the University of Hawaii. I'm currently an affiliate faculty. He earned a doctorate in history from the University of Oklahoma in 1981. In the 1980s, he worked at and directed an independent living center in Oklahoma, organized numerous community coalitions, and was involved in the implementation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. In 1990, he moved to California, where he served as training director at the World Institute on Disability. In 1993, he received the first federal funding to research disability culture. After moving to New Mexico, he co-founded the Not-for-Profit Institute on Disability Culture and with his wife, Lillian Gonzalez Brown, in 1994. Brown's books include Movie Stars and Sensuous Scars, Essays on the Journey from Disability Shame to Disability Pride in 2003, and Surprised to Be Standing, A Spiritual Journey in 2011. Brown relocated to the California Bay Area in summer of 2014, where he continues to write, advocate, and teach. Blog posts can be found at the www.instituteondisabilityculture.org/manifesto. And he's on Twitter. Steve is at DisCulture, so DISCULTURE. And as always, our IELTS conversations are presented by the IELTSNet, which is operated by the Independent Living Research Utilization Program at TIRR Memorial Hermann in partnership with Nickel and April. Support for the presentation was provided by the U.S. Department of Education Rehabilitation Services Administration, and no official endorsement of the Department of Education should be inferred. So, without further ado, I will go ahead and let Steve take it away.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That was Mary, right?
Yes, this is Mary. I'm sorry. Yes, yeah. I'm Mary from April. I forgot to introduce myself.
So we've had a lot of emails, but it's the first time I've heard your voice, so so thank you. Well, first of all, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for asking. And secondly, I heard some people as they were signing on, but I didn't really, I don't know if I heard everybody, so I didn't get a sense of how many people or groups are actually here. Do you have a sense of that?
Sorry about that. I accidentally muted myself.
Okay.
Hey, Steve. Sorry, I muted myself. on accident. But yeah, I do have a sense. Looks like we have a pretty large crew right now. We have about, it looks like about 40 people online.
Okay, great. So, thank you. Part of why I asked that is I really am hoping this is a conversation. That's how I understood it. So I know that Mary was talking about muting, which I would actually do if I could, because you might hear some trains go by. We're very close to BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit trains, and I have no idea how many are going to come around while we're talking, and even though I have a headset on, people tend to hear it. So if you hear a noise in the background, that's what it is.
And Steve, just to let you know, if at some point you would like me to unmute everybody, just let me know and I can do that. We'll just give them a fair warning.
Okay. So let me start by saying that as we were beginning to talk about this and thinking, I mean, I was asked to talk about disability culture. That's not going to shock anybody who knows who I am. And I actually, Mary, when she was first emailing me about this, sent me a quote that's attributed to me and that may well be from me, but I could never find it. So that's one of the interesting things about being out in the public eye is you never know what's gonna come back to haunt you or surprise you or remind you of something. And in this case, it's actually one that I've seen a couple of times, and the first time I thought I saw it, I thought I found it, but then I couldn't find it again, and I actually can't remember exactly what it is. So that's probably not too fascinating, but it's a way of saying that as we were starting all of this, I came up with the title, Promoting Disability Pride, Exploring the Evolution of Disability Culture. And then I looked at it further as exploring a personal and professional history of the evolution of disability culture. And I'm using the PowerPoint as a guide if people are following that. So the reason I'm looking at that is it's now been since the late 1980s when I first began talking and writing about disability culture. And so it really is both a personal and a professional, because it's been something I've been doing as I've moved along in various organizations, and for the last 12 years or so in academia. So looking at how it's evolved for me personally and how it's evolved professionally and just how it's evolved is something that I was thinking about as I was exploring what to do today. And I'm actually going to stop and ask if there's some way to know if everybody can hear me well. Since I can't see any faces, I can't tell. So, and I know people are muted, and that's great, but I just want to make sure everybody can hear.
So I just heard from our transcript folks that everything's coming in clear, and the folks on the chat are saying it's coming in clear.
Great, thank you. So as Mary said in the introduction, I got a doctorate in 1981, probably before some people on this call were born, which is it's a weird thing these days, but it's probably true. And that was at the University of Oklahoma, and it was in history. And I've written about this, and so some of you may have actually read it or heard me talk about this, but it wasn't long after getting that degree when I encountered job discrimination. And remember, this is the early 1980s. And I was hired to write a book for a company in Tulsa. And when they heard that I used crutches, which they did at the time, they decided that I couldn't write the book. And all kinds of, stupid things were said, like a person using crutches can't write a book. And in Oklahoma, as some of you will know, football is a big thing. And I was told if I had the physique of a football player, I'd have the stamina to do this. Since I didn't, they didn't think I would. And in those days, I was actually quite tall. I was about 6'4", and I was also very skinny, so I didn't at all look like a football player. But I had had the serendipity when I was teaching as a graduate student, and then for 1 year after graduating at OU, to have a couple of students in one of my classes who were involved in the development of what's now Progressive Independence in Norman. In those days, it was called the Independent Living Project. And I began to get to know them, and they began to get to know me, and we talked about my going to a meeting of the ILP, the Independent Living Project, and seeing if I'd be interested in doing any volunteering. And I did that, and I was really impressed by what they were doing. They were actually planning a statewide conference, and they were doing all kinds of cool things, one of which was they were bringing in two national speakers, people I'd never heard of at that point, but names that might be familiar to some of you these days. One was Frank Bo, who was passed away now, but was an author of many books, including one in the late 1970s, I believe, called Handicapping America. And another lady that probably most of you have heard of named Judy Humer. So this was pretty cool. And as I began to get to know the Independent Living Project more, and after this job discrimination happened, I started hanging out at the ILP pretty much every day. And in the fall of 1982, they had two new jobs that were created. One of them was to do peer counseling and skills coordinating and community organizing. And so I applied for and got that job, but started working at the ILP. And I didn't know anything about disability, but I did know how to find things out, which in those days were going to the library and looking in the card catalog, which is actually how I found Handicapping America. And I was reading some of the things that were around the office. So the person who was the director of the program at that time, Helen Kuth, who's still one of my best friends and who I consider my mentor in this movement, knew about this magazine called The Disability Rag, and she'd ordered it. So I'm reading The Disability Rag in the early to mid-1980s, and they're doing all kinds of things that were very appealing to me. Like, they had this cartoon, and they had a whole series of items that they called Disability Cool. That was kind of shocking, Disability Cool. I wonder what that is. And then there it was in front of me, like this cartoon. But what really, I think, because this is all going back and trying to recreate it in my mind, I think that the thing that really hit me was an article that Mary Johnson, who was the editor of the Rag, did as an interview with Carol Gill. Carol Gill at that time was in LA, now she's at the University of Illinois in Chicago, and she's a psychologist with a disability who, in this interview, was talking about why people with disabilities needed our own culture. And that really hit me too, because I had grown up in the Jewish culture. My family belonged to a synagogue, and I was really aware of what cultural artifacts and what it was like to be part of a culture, but that particular culture didn't resonate with me so much. When I was reading Carol talking about disability culture, it did resonate. And it kind of brought together for me a lot of my passion. So my passion as a historian, my passion as what today we call human rights activists, I don't know what I was calling it in those days, and my passion for learning about different kinds of culture, what in those days, anyway, we called highbrow and lowbrow culture. So highbrow, things like academic books and lowbrow things like comic books and TV. And I liked all of those things. And disability culture felt to me like a way to bring that all together. So the 1980s is happening. And a lot of very interesting things happened at the CIL, which I've avoided calling a CIL because, and Helen avoided calling it a CIL because we didn't have a consumer-controlled board. This was before the law mandated that. And so in 1984, we actually walked out over the issue of consumer control and a number of other things, which I did write about and was published in the Rag. And then I worked for a few years at a state advocacy office, and then I came back as the director of Progressive Independence. Now it was PI. And one of the things that I did was help to facilitate a spin-off to a consumer-controlled board. But during this whole time, I'm still thinking about writing disability culture. And the more I'm thinking about it and the more I'm contemplating it, the more attractive it is to me. So a few things happened in 1989, 1990, right around there, actually maybe more than one in 1990. So one of them was that NICOL, of course, the National Council on Independent Living, has this annual conference every year. And I thought it would be kind of interesting to try and do something at the 1990 conference that related to disability culture. There was also statewide IL conference in Tulsa that was right after the NICOL conference. And there was something else that I'm forgetting, so it must not be that important. So the NICOL conference, I had the feeling that if I just submitted what I was thinking about, that it wasn't going to go very far because I wasn't very well known. And I thought, well, who can I get so that it's going to be an accepted presentation? And I contacted these two people who I knew somewhat, one a bit better than the other. And the first one was Beauty Human, and she agreed to be on the panel. And the second one was Justin Dart, who at that time was in Texas, and I knew him not pretty well, but I knew him from being in that region. So Judy and Justin and I submitted this proposal called Speakers of Movement that had its own title, but Voices of Independence. That was the subtitle. So, and we decided, primarily Judy and I, because Justin was working very hard at that point on getting the ADA passed. So primarily Judy and I were talking about it, and we decided that what we wanted to do was talk about one of our stories. And we wanted to leave about half the time, I think it was a 90-minute session, so we wanted to leave about half of the time for audience participation. So I talked about the walkout, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, and Judy talked about what it was like being at a camp when she was a kid, where she was around other kids with disabilities. And Justin talked about the ADA. Justin kind of swooped in and talked about the ADA and swooped out because he was really busy meeting folks in those days. So we did this, and Judy talked about her stuff, and I talked about my stuff, and then we opened it for audience participation. And that's probably when I knew that we'd really hit on something. Because I swear that every single person in that audience wanted to talk. They all had stories to tell. And we were really happy to hear them. And we also didn't have time for everybody who wanted to talk to talk. So when we left, Judy and I both looked at each other and said, we really have something here. And I was on my way from NICOL to Tulsa to kind of do a similar thing. And Judy was going back to WIT, I guess, at that point. the World Institute on Disability in Oakland. So I came back from this meeting in D.C., and I came to Tulsa. And in Tulsa, I organized a panel. It was a large panel of like 8 or 9 people, and the basic question was, we're exploring this thing, or maybe more accurately, I'm exploring this thing, called disability culture, and we kind of want to know what people are thinking about it. So, is it a good thing? Is it not a good thing? What is it? And each of us talked about it. And, of course, I talked about it as a good thing, and some people weren't very clear on what it was or wasn't, and all of those things were talked about. But what kind of really hit me in those days and at that stage was that people had really strong reactions to it. Sometimes they didn't like the idea, but they had really strong reactions to it. So I knew it was something to continue to explore. And right around then was when I felt it was time for me to move on. And so I was lucky enough to get a job at the World Institute on Disability, and I moved to Oakland. And I worked there for the next 3 years. And I'm going to actually stop and ask if anybody has questions or comments at this point.
And again, if you have a question, if you can push *6. Or a comment.
Everybody's still awake, right?
I think so. I think we're hanging in there, with me. I know this is a new, we've never really muted everybody before, but we've had some issues in the past. So we're trying to figure out a way to make it work, but still make it conversation-y.
Okay.
So again, so, *6. Looks like maybe somebody, somebody from CART just said, I'm awake, but no, I'm awake too, but no questions.
I'm glad. You know, it's a little funny when Mary and I were talking about this. I was saying that it's been a very long time, maybe 10 years. I mean, a really long time since I've only done a phone teleconference. So I'm used to kind of doing webinars where I don't necessarily see people, but one of the techniques of doing the webinars is to ask every few minutes if anybody has any questions, if there's anything going on. So that's why you'll probably get that from me. But if
Perfect.
Anybody does...
Yeah, and if it any... the audience wants to say something, you can push *6 and unmute yourself, and I'll know that you did that. And so, you know, we can go from there. But so, yeah, go ahead and do that anytime.
Thank you. Okay, but until somebody does that, I'll keep going. So in 1991, I believe, I had now started talking publicly about disability culture. And for some people it may be a little hard to imagine, but it was quite controversial in those days. And one example of that is that we used to have these informal lunches at WID, and sometimes we talk about different topics more than just the social lunch. And I remember talking about disability culture one day, and I was blown away because there were people in the room who had different sexual orientations. I believe that the person who worked at WID in those days who was transgendered was in that room. There were people of various religions, lots of different kinds of disability background, but we all must have been from the U.S. On that particular day, although that wasn't necessarily true of everybody. And so somebody made the comment that there couldn't be a disability culture because they were Americans. And I heard that, and I was like, what? But what? And then I kept hearing it. I heard that several times, that same comment in some variation of that. And so I was thinking, okay, so what does this mean? And what I finally decided was, and I think this is accurate, was what it meant was disability was seen as so stigmatizing, such a terrible thing in those days, that nobody wanted to add that to any already stigmatizing characteristics that they might have, like being gay or being black or anything else. So that's where the, as near as I could tell, that's where there can't be a disability culture because of Americans came from, which always struck me as odd because I was never saying, have not said, and don't say that people only belong to or identify with one culture. We all identify with lots of different cultures. And so that was going on, and then, as you might be able to tell, I can be a talking head. And so when I was first talking about disability culture, I was doing it in the way that I knew how to talk, which is kind of from an academic point of view. But I realized really quickly that that wasn't getting across what I wanted to get across. And so I started bringing other things in, like cartoons. Callahan was publishing his cartoons in those days, and I used some of those, and music, and videos, which in those days were videotapes. And because I write, and one of the things I write is poetry, I also tried to bring that in. So in 1991, there was a conference in Arkansas, a Region 6 Independent Living Conference, and I was asked to speak, so I did a presentation, and the bulk of the presentation was about kind of finding my disability identity in my 30s when I was in the hospital, and that was later published in a journal and in Movie Stars. But I also wanted to bring the disability culture part in there, and so I very consciously wrote a poem. And the poem is called Tell Your Story. And it's on the website, the PowerPoint that you have, and it's also on the Institute website. So I don't know if it's really helpful to read it here or not, but I could use some feedback about that if people want to hear it or not. And I won't be insulted either way.
I think, well, folks are saying that. Steve, I have a couple of questions from the chat room. Is that okay?
Right. That's perfect.
I was wondering what exactly you mean by culture as applied to disability.
Okay, I will get there in a minute, so let me hang on that one.
Okay, and then there's another one. What's the difference between disability culture and disability history?
So let me just go to the definition. And let me tell you that I will answer both those questions, I promise, but I think I need to do a little bit of background before I answer it. And so let me do that. Be patient, please. In the 92-93, I was ready to do disability culture. That's what I wanted to do. And I had met Lillian, and she agreed with that. And we were looking at moving from California and starting an institute on disability culture. So one of the things I did was apply to what used to be NIDR until very recently, National Institute on Disability Rehabilitation Research, for a one-year Switzer Fellowship to do research on disability culture. And I got that. And so from 93 to 94, I had that year to do research. And also in that year we moved to southern New Mexico, and we created the Institute. And so in the beginning of, well, let me just parenthetically as they say, that when you, at least in those days, when you had this fellowship, you were asked to do a final report, and that was actually the only thing you were asked to do, other than some accounting, to be accountable for having had this fellowship. And the report could have been done in a lot of different ways, but what I decided to do was to write a monograph. So I wrote this monograph called Investigating a Culture of Disability and : final report, because that's what it was. And so it's, I don't know, 150 page probably in today's world, monograph. And it started out with an executive summary. And I just want to read one paragraph, or part of one paragraph, from that summary. So this is 94. The existence of a disability culture is a relatively new and contested idea. Not surprising, perhaps, for a group that has long been described with terms like, and these are in quotes, invalid, impaired, limited, crippled, and then end of the quote, and so forth. The disability culture movement is running full steam ahead. While I write and you read, multiplying numbers of people are creating rapidly increasing examples of disability culture. So I did this monograph, and one of the things that I have in it, and that I put in the PowerPoint, but it was originally done for this monograph, I called the chart. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with this, but in those days, there were actually a number of paradigm charts that were going around. There was an independent living paradigm, a rehabilitation paradigm, and so I took actually the left-hand column, which is definitions of problems, locus of problems, social roles, solutions to problems, who controls, and desired outcomes. I took all those from the previous paradigm chart. And then I created two columns that were my creation. And the first one is called community assistance / medical / charity paradigm. And so as you can imagine, it includes looking at the medical model. In social roles, it includes people with disabilities as patients, clients, charity recipients, or non-existent, not as being thought of. And then I created disability rights culture / pride paradigm. And in that one, social roles for family and community members, customers, coworkers, advocates, the same as anyone else. And I'm kind of, believe it or not, going on about this, not to delay answering your questions, but as part of the answer, because I had now written this monograph. I'd been talking about disability culture, and for quite a while now, for 3 or 4 years, which in those days was quite a while, and people started asking me for a one-sentence definition of disability culture. And when they do that, and a number of people did that, I'd go, well, let me see. I've written a monograph about it. I can talk about it. But a one-sentence definition? And so, but I got asked about that enough that one very funny day, a Saturday, if I remember correctly, in New Mexico, I sat down and attempted to write a one-sentence definition of disability culture. But what happened instead was I wrote an article. And the article was eventually published in Mainstream Magazine, called We Are Who We Are, So Who Are We? And in that article, I included a one paragraph, not a one sentence, but a one paragraph definition of disability culture, my definition. And it's been republished in Movie Stars and other places, and I still use it. So here's the answer to how I'm defining disability culture. People with disabilities have forged a group identity. We share a common history of oppression and a common bond of resilience. We generate art, music, literature, and other expressions of our lives, our culture, infused from our experience of disability. Most importantly, we are proud of ourselves as people with disabilities. We claim our disabilities with pride as part of our identity. We are who we are. We are people with disabilities. So, expanding on that, or just talking about it a little bit, for me, the purest definition of disability culture is when somebody with a disability is infusing their experiences or experiences that they're aware of from a disability perspective into whatever they perceive as culture that they generate. It's different from history. Disability history can certainly be a part of disability. And disability culture can be a part of disability history. But from a historical perspective, we can talk about disability in certain ways millions of years ago, because there have been skeletons that have been found that show people millions of years ago with disabilities. And there have been some conclusions from that, for example, whether they're right or not, some of the conclusions are that people with disabilities were taken care of, or at least some people were, because the skeletons are old enough to demonstrate that. And that's an example of history of disability, or an example of disability in history, but it's not disability culture. On the other hand, if we look in the last 20 years, I think you can say that disability culture is a part of disability history, and that disability history has played a role in the development of disability culture, because it's only probably in the last 20 years that people have really been looking at people with disabilities in the sense of how we've impacted how we've impacted history, or how we're looked at within the boundaries of history. So, did that answer those two questions, or not?
I think that it does. People say that it's an awesome definition, and that they like that we are who we are. No frills, just us.
Thank you. So having said that, here's another definition. This one I actually read a number of years ago. It was published on the Kids of Self-Advocate site. It was published anonymously, but a few years ago I actually met the author of the piece, which is, I think it's just What is Disability Culture? I think that's what it's called. And the URL is on the PowerPoint. So Naomi Ortiz is her name. She's in Tucson. And she's actually right now working on a blog that she calls Self-Care for Social Justice, and working on how people working for social justice can take care of themselves. And so every once in a while she'll post usually a fairly, not necessarily lengthy, but in-depth, deep blog post, and some of you may know her. So anyway, she wrote, you remember she was writing it for Kids of Self-Advocates and writing it as probably a person in her 20s at that point. Most people who are disabled do not have parents who are disabled. That means we are different than other cultures who learn their culture from their parents. We have to learn it from each other. Not all people agree people with disabilities have a culture, but there are thousands of disability rights groups, books, and materials that explain we do. So I really like that definition too, because one of the things that people were saying in the early days was, you know, you get your culture from your family. And a lot of people with disabilities, of course, didn't get their culture from their families because their families either didn't have disabilities or didn't know much about disabilities. So, you know, this was to me a really good example of, not the only example, but a good example of we actually learn our culture from each other because we don't necessarily learn it from our family. So, anything else at this point? Any other questions or comments?
Not yet. Let me know, you know, if you ever want to go to discussion, and I can unmute folks. But until then, if folks have anything, go ahead and push *6, or you can type it into the CART chat.
Okay, so I put a PowerPoint slide in here called "Why Does Steve Call Disability Culture Global and Diverse?" And there's actually a very specific reason for that, so that's why I put it that way. In 2007, I was asked to go to Norway and to participate in a PhD seminar in Bergen, Norway. And Jan Kore, the person who asked me, gave me the title of the talk that he wanted me to give, and it was Disability Culture, Global and Diverse, ? And so I thought, well, okay, this is interesting. And so kind of one of my goals of this presentation was to take the question mark away and to make the statement, disability culture, global and diverse. And it was actually coming at kind of a good time for me because I was starting to want to explore what I could find about disability culture in non-Anglo countries. And that was and is kind of interesting because I only speak English. So it's a bit limiting, but at the same time, and this was before a lot of Google translation was going on, or at least before I was aware of it. And so it was kind of interesting to try and ferret out examples of disability culture happening in other countries, but I was. And so, for example, one of the things I found in those days was a group in Israel called Na'ala Da'at, which I'm probably not saying right, but they were billed, and maybe still are billed, as the world's only deafblind theater troupe. And they've actually become quite well known, and they have tourists come to their theater, so they're not so hard to find on the internet these days. Another person slash group I found was a group in Norway, well, actually Sweden, but they became most popular in Norway, called Boys on Wheels, and they're a boy band, three men in wheelchairs, using wheelchairs, and the leader is a guy named, I can see him, but I just forgot his name. Anyway, he's a person with cerebral palsy who's also a comedian. And so Boys on Wheels was doing these comedic songs, and one of the songs was called Making Love in the Handicapped Toilet, and you can find that on YouTube if you want, in English. And so I was finding examples like this, and there are other ones. And so I talked about some of those when I was in Bergen, and actually they told me about some when I was there. Like there's a hip-hop, I think, group in somewhere in Norway, I forget where, called Cripple Crew. And so these things were going on. And actually Lillian and I had the the wonderful pleasure of going to Kassel, Germany, and somewhere around, somewhere in the 90s, actually. And we saw examples of different kinds of disability culture there at what they call a cripple festival. We wouldn't use that language, but basically it was a disability festival, and there were lots of things going on, including performers. And one of the performers was a group called Station 17, and you can find them on the internet, although it's not so easy to find their information, but they're actually a fascinating group. They are musicians who are actually all living in an institution in Germany, and the institution that they were in is called Station 17, that's where the name comes from, and they brought some music therapists in, and the music therapists were working with this group of people who they thought were really talented. You know, and so they formed this group, and they've actually been, they've made lots of records, they've toured all over the world, many of them are no longer living in the institution. So there were all these kinds of things going on. So there were things happening globally. And then diversity, I just give you one. Is I don't know if spin-off is quite the right word, but I'll use that, a spin-off of hip-hop. And Leroy Moore, who's the founder of the Crip Hop Nation and who lives in this area, so we've become friends, always talks about Crip-Hop is more than music. So it is music, and there are people all over the world, actually, who are doing Crip-Hop as music, but it's also social justice, it's writing. Leroy himself is a poet who does spoken words. So, and of course, because a lot of the hip-hop movement itself came from minorities, came from black culture and other non-white cultures, so that's Crip-Hop. So there is a diversity that's happening now that maybe it wasn't so aware of in the early 90s when I first began talking about this. So, and then here's another, looking at the PowerPoint, another example of the global reach of disability culture these days. In the, I guess, in the early 2000s, when I started talking about disability culture and trying to convey how popular it had become, I started doing searches on Google and Yahoo just to see, entering the phrase disability culture in quotes, and entering the phrase to see how many returns I got. So I have this return from December 24, 2003, where Google returned 8,520 hits and Yahoo returned 5,740 hits. And then I kept doing it, but I didn't record it religiously until about 2008. And then I started, partly because I was doing it for a class I used to guest lecture in, I started recording it about every 6 months. And so some 2008, which is 5 years later, there's 43,700 hits from Google and 280,000 hits from Yahoo. And then the one that totally blew me away was in September 2010 when I got 43,900 hits on Google and 41 million on Yahoo. And when I first saw that 41 million, I was like, oh no, it's really gone down. I thought it was like 4,100. But it was 41 million. I'm like, where in the heck are 41 million hits coming from? But it actually stayed that way through August 2011, at which point there were 50,700,000 returns on Yahoo and 12,900,000 on Google. And then it's gone down since then, so obviously the algorithms have changed. But the last time I looked, which was about a month ago, there were 79,500 returns on Google and 92,400 on Yahoo. Don't ask me what they all are. I've never had time to go through them. So I don't know, but I know if you enter disability culture, you'll get a lot of hits. So kind of kind of all over the place.
Great. And Steve, I just want to make a quick announcement. I apologize, folks. I'm just learning how to use this new system. But now when you push *6, you should be able to ask questions and unmute yourself. So before, I guess that when folks were pushing it, it was saying that I had the lines muted. So just to let you know, Steve, people are interested in listening. That was operation error. We have a bunch of calls lining up now.
Okay. So
yes, hello. Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering I was wondering when you talk about disability culture, wouldn't the present day be more, because we're so into integration and so into, look, I'm just a regular person, and not associating, you know, I am just a person with a disability, and a disability becomes secondary, and that personhood becomes first. That disability culture, by that nature, is going to be waning?
Well, I can give you a one-word answer to the second part, which is no, it's not waning. But I think there's a broader answer to it, and there's also a more complicated answer. So part of it is that the way you describe disability as secondary to personhood, and the phrase that we've been using for years in this country now of people with disabilities, that's becoming kind of controversial. It's always been controversial in certain places, like England, for example, in the UK, has never liked people with disabilities. They do disabled person with a capital D. And there are a number of people in this country who are looking at it that way now. So it's not quite as cut and dry, I think, as we might think. So that's one thing. But the other thing is, this is why I think it's really important. And this is what I've been saying now for a number of years. And that is that no matter who we are, black, white, yellow, gay, straight, trans, Jewish, Catholic, Muslim, whatever, no matter who we are, I believe that it's important that we have pride in who we are. So that goes with having a disability, too. If we are somebody with a disability, I think it's important that we have pride in who we are as a person with a disability. But I also think it's a little bit broader than that. And that is that because it's a part of who we are, because disability is a part of who we are, and because there's a disability culture, I think it's really important to know about disability culture, because we want to know about, in my view, we want to know about ourselves. You know, if I'm a historian, or as a historian, I'm interested in how history has developed. As a person with a disability, I'm also interested in how disability has been perceived, both currently and over time, because of that historical interest. So I think it's really important that we know who we are. But I also think it's important for another reason. And that is, if we don't know who we are, how can we talk to somebody else about who we are? How can we expect somebody to want to include somebody with a disability if they don't understand disability? And if we don't understand disability, how are we able to convey that to other people? So those are reasons I think it's really important to understand who we are as a culture. And I should now say that I don't think there's a disability culture. I think there are lots of cultures and subcultures. And I always thought that, but when I started doing this, I started with disability culture as an overall term because I had to start somewhere. But there are certainly lots of subsets within that culture. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
Great. And there's one more question, if that's okay.
That's good.
Hi, this is not a question, but a comment. My name is Terry. I just wanted to say that that I appreciate you bringing up Callahan because nobody ever does. And I appreciate your embracing the dark humor of the disability movement. It's nice to see.
Thank you. I missed something, though. What did you say people don't bring up?
A lot of people do not appreciate the dark humor on the side of disability, such like Callahan and like you're saying, Trip Hop and all of that. There are a lot of, and they get all weird about it. And I just really appreciate hearing this story, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Other comments, questions?
Great. One more comment, it might have been answered, I'm not sure. Just wondering, RJ is wondering if you've included deaf people and studied their rich deaf culture and language and history.
Mm. Sorry, I missed a word there. So included deaf culture and deaf history in disability culture?
Yeah.
Is that the question?
Yeah.
Okay. So, well, again, the short answer is yes. And certainly there's controversy over whether people who are deaf and are in deaf culture would want to be part of disability culture. So it may be a good point to say that I grew up in the disability rights movement in Oklahoma in the 80s in a very cross-disability movement. It was wonderful, actually. We had people from what at that time was most of the various disability groups. You know, there were people who were blind, people who were deaf, people who used chairs and had other mobility impairments. There were a few people, although not too many, with what we today call psychiatric disabilities. Nobody, I think, in those days included people with cognitive disabilities, and I don't remember anybody. Autism wasn't something that we really thought about in those days. But one thing that we did think about and did include were people with AIDS. That was developing in the 80s. So, but to be very specific about deafness, one of the PowerPoints is a slide that says some examples of disability culture. And if you go down to the fourth entry, it's a guy named Sean Forbes, who some of you may have heard of. He's a deaf hip-hop artist, and he's pretty popular. You can find lots of his videos and songs on YouTube. And the one I put here is called Lit Mambo, and I put this one because it's a fun one. I really like it. Marley Matlin is in it, and I actually have used this in classes a lot, because it's fun. I did, a blog earlier this year on my top 25 disability pride songs. Which is actually somewhat hard to do because there's a lot of very cool disability songs out these days, disability pride songs. And I included a different one with different song of Sean's called Watch These Hands, which he said he really liked because he said most people don't use that one. There's in Hawaii and other places, but the lead singer is in Hawaii, is a guy who goes by the stage name of Ed Chevy. And he's part of a group called Beethoven's Nightmare. And they bill themselves either as the first or the only deaf rock and roll band. And you can find some of their music online, too. There's a song theirs I've used a lot called Turn It Up Louder. And as a hearing person with pretty good hearing who's seen them in concert, I have to say they are really loud, as you would expect. And then, of course, you know, I'm using music because it's something people sometimes don't think about with deaf folks, but also because I like music, and that's what came right to my mind. But there's certainly lots of other examples of deaf folks and deaf culture. And so from my perspective, yes, it's a part of it. On the slide, there's a few other things you can find online. One, the first one is called Everybody, an Artifact History of Disability in America, and that's at the Smithsonian. It's an online exhibition, as well as an in-person one that you can see in Washington. There's a really wonderful curator at the, is it called American Museum of History, something like that. Anyway, her name is Catherine Ott, and she's very aware of disability and likes to do lots of exhibitions about disability. So that's a very cool exhibition. And one of the things that you can see on it is a poem by a guy named Neil Marcus. He wrote this poem in the 80s called Disabled Country, and it's about his country is disabled. And so I'll let you find that if you're interested. He also performed a play in the 80s and 90s mostly called Storm Reading. I always describe it as a one-person play that it takes three people to do because Neil has a speech disability as well as using a wheelchair. And when he performs the play, he talked some. He had a voice interpreter and a sign language interpreter. But the play was from his writings. There's lots of disability pride parades around now. The one that's been around the longest as an annual parade is in Chicago. And so there's a link to a description of, I think it's their 2009 parade. There's a wonderful video from Mobility International USA called Loud, Proud, and Passionate. It's all women from all over the world who are talking about why they are loud, proud, and passionate. And one of the things they do in that video is hold up signs of various kinds of work that they do. There's a woman named Teal Scherer who has created a web series. She's an actress, and she's created a web series called My Gippy Life. And so there's a link here to the first episode. And then some of these you may have heard of. This person you probably haven't heard of, because he's local to Hawaii. His name is Damon Boyser, and he's an extreme athlete. He's a quad who does things like fly out of planes, and he scaled down. Fairly high. I think around 20-story hotel in Waikiki. So he does those kind of things. So athletics is also something that would be included in culture. And I just included some of these examples to give you an idea of some of the things that were going on. And then there's a comic book called The Silver Scorpion. You can find that online too. I have a URL for it. It's a slide that's headed comic. And The Silver Scorpion was created by a group of youth about 5 years ago, I think. They they met in Syria. It was mostly Syrian and American youth. And they worked together to collaborate to create this comic book character called The Silver Scorpion, who loses his legs in a landmine accident and becomes a superhero. And actually, it's also, I think, developed into a web series. I don't know if that's still going on. So it's had a lot of legs, and I keep hearing there's going to be a second issue, but I haven't seen that yet. Okay, so one other comment, and then I think discussion would be great, which is kind of building on the why I think it's disability culture is important, and maybe another addendum to that is to say that I don't think knowing who we are as somebody with a disability and as part of a disability culture separates us, or has to separate us, maybe is a better way of putting it, from the more mainstream culture. I actually think that in some ways it helps us to fit in better because we have a better handle on who we are, and this is what I wanted to say, and this is the way I think that CILs can use disability culture. And that is that there are all these examples around from disability culture that demonstrate disability rights, history, talents, and resources. And I said I was going to stop, but I actually wanted to say one more thing that I just thought of. I have to take a drink of water first. One of the things that's going on right now, which I'm sure you're all aware of, is the things going on around the 25th anniversary of the signing of the ADA. And so there's this wonderful website called the ADA Legacy Project, and the website is adalegacy.com. And the goal of the ADA Legacy Project is to preserve, celebrate, and educate. And of course, because I'm sure most of you know this, the bus has been going around the country and is going around again, the Road to Freedom bus. And there are a lot of people who are doing various things, I'm sure some of you are, in relation to this celebration. And one of the things going on in San Francisco is there's a woman named Alice Wong who's created what's called the Disability Visibility Project. And she's worked in conjunction with StoryCorps, and people are telling their story. So people over this area, but also all over the country, are getting are getting a chance to go into StoryCorps booth and talk about their disability story. So, and she's got a great website, disabilityvisibilityproject.com, I believe, and publishes lots of things. She's also very active on Facebook and Twitter, and so you can find her and the project there. And now, I'm going to try and be quiet and ask Mary for you to open it to discussion.
Great. So again, go ahead and push *6 to unmute yourself. And as that's happening, I've got a couple from the chat room. One is, do you think that disability culture, as it stands today, is fairly inclusive of family members and friends of those with disabilities?
I'm thinking about that. Well, I'm not sure that I can give a answer to that beyond my own experience and my own what I see, you know, like on social media and other places. And I think the answer is yes. But I also have to qualify that and say that I'm sure there are examples where that's not true. Well, actually, I can think of one real big example where that's not true. So let me give a qualified yes to that. But let me also say that, as some of you may be aware, we just had around the country this past weekend, in this area, it was on Sunday, and I think a lot of places it was on Sunday, we just had what's called the Disability Day of Mourning. And it started out in the autism community, but it's at least in here, has spread to other disabilities. And it's not a fun thing, but it's certainly part of our culture, and that is memorializing people who have been killed, people with disabilities who have been killed by their family members. And in our case, it also expanded to police brutality. So there's certainly plenty of people who would have reason to give no answer to that question. So maybe my answer is there isn't a yes or no response, but it's somewhere in between.
Okay. So one more from the chat room. How do examples of disability culture differ from the idea of the, quote, super crip?
Well, not everybody. Yeah, I think this is accurate. Not everybody who's involved in disability culture is a super crip. That's the first thing. Secondly, part of the super crip mythology, I think, doesn't come from crip. It comes from people who are outside. Not all of it. There are certainly many of us who, for various reasons, have tried to live up to that super crip role and probably have fulfilled that. But, you know, there are a lot of people within disability culture who are most definitely not super crips. They may be, for example, creating something once a year. They may be doing something quietly at a very local level. So I think there could be people who are doing disability culture or super crips, but I don't think everybody is. And one more thing about that, which is that I think talking about that and talking about what a super crip is actually part of it. It's a characteristic of talking about the culture.
Okay. So I'm gonna try something. I think I'm going to unmute everybody to see if we can get some discussion going for the next couple minutes. Is that okay, Steve?
Works for me.
All right. Are folks ready? I'm going to unmute everybody. Hopefully we can have a little bit of discussion about what is disability culture.
Oh, I hear music. Harry, I don't know if you can hear me, but all I hear is
music.
Sorry, folks. All right. Sorry about that, folks. I thought I'd give it a try, but that's why we got to this new system. So if you have a question, please push *6 and let us know. While folks are doing that, I just want to say thank you again to Steve. And also I wanted to give a shout-out to our folks behind the scenes. Thank you, Bill at Skill, for recording our conversation. And thanks for Larry for doing captioning for us. The cart, that's been really great to have. And it looks like we might have one question lined up.
Okay, and I wanted to add
nice caller.
Yes, hello.
Yes. This is Dina Lucido at Delta Center. Hello?
Yep. Go ahead.
Hi.
From Delta.
Okay. I was wondering if Stephen had heard of something in the St. Louis area called the Disability Project that does theater, and are there others like it throughout the the country. It's not just people with disabilities. It's an integrated format of performance. So you have people with disabilities and without. The director of the program is Joan Lipkin, who's a playwright.
So I know that name. I don't know the name of the theater project that you mentioned. It didn't ring a bell.
Well, she's with the Uppity Theater.
That
Uppity Theater. Yeah, and then she has an offshoot of that where she integrates people with disability into theater called the Disability Project. And I didn't know if you were aware of that or of others around the country.
Yeah. So to the first part of your question, no, I wasn't aware of that one. I am aware of some. I'm sure I'm not aware of everything. So one of the things that we've been doing on our institute website is we have a page of links and resources, and I add things as I learn about them. There are some integrated as well as other theater troupes around the country and the world for that matter, and also dance. There's a lot of integrated dance troupes. So there's a group in Michigan called, that I think is still around, called the Wild Swan Theater. There in Colorado, there's one called I believe it's Colorado, called Family, spelled P-H-A-M-A-L-Y. Those two came to mind right away. In the Bay Area, there's, I don't know if they still exist, but there was a kind of a comedy troupe called Lie Crips, which was all people with disabilities, I believe. Also in the Bay Area, there's a fairly well-known now integrated dance troupe called the AXIS Dance Troupe, AXIS. So as I think about it, I think about more, but the basic response is yes, there are lots of different kinds of groups around. There's also in the Bay Area, there's a group called the Disability Comedians Act. And there have been disability comedians around for a long time. And when I lived here in the early 90s, there were comedians who performed together, but I don't think they were formalized as an act, as a few of them are now. I want to really say this, that it's not just the U.S., it's all over the world, that people are coming together in various kinds of cultural entities, you know, dance, theater, music. So, yeah, it's definitely happening. And there's lots of writers with disabilities, lots of really good writers with disabilities who are writing from a disability perspective. In fact, one of the things that I've been doing recently is trying to understand how to use social media better. So for about a month, I guess, maybe not quite that long, was using Twitter to promote the hashtag Promoting Disability Pride and talking about some of those different kind of groups that I was aware of. And social media has become a real treasure to find a lot of these kinds of groups and people who are doing these things that are around.
Great. I think that there's another line open. Is it Rick, maybe?
No, I'm fine. It's okay. Well, no, I do have a question. It's just, you know, you talk about disability pride, but I'm just wondering in terms of, because there's pride with, you know, every disability group. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know,
yes.
you know, Asperger's hasn't embraced her. I'm an Asperger, you know. People with HIV have embraced, you know, that. And they end up having their own social pride, but it doesn't always encompass the whole disability huge group. Am I making any sense there? You know,
yep.
It seems like it's, you know, I don't know. Except for your example, you know, like, oh, there's a disability parade, which I didn't even know about, you know, and it's like, I'm sure that embraces all disability. Just wondering, so is it more predominant that it's just each group, and then there's these overwhelming, like the disability parade?
Where are you located? Just out of curiosity.
I'm in Northern Kentucky, Cincinnati, Ohio, which is
okay.
Centers for Accessible Living.
So I think the reason I ask you where you're located is I think a lot mm-hmm. of times the way those things develop are very localized. So like I said, I was really lucky in Oklahoma to be in a very cross disability at that time, very cross disability group. The day of mourning that I was talking about that we just did here, there was a person with using a wheelchair who spoke. There was a person with Asperger's who spoke. There were people with a lot of differences. There wasn't a huge number of people there. There was about 60 people, but they represented a lot of different disability groups. And I think, speaking of Ohio, there used to be a guy who came from Ohio named Roland Sykes. Some of you may remember him or have heard his name. And he was a very militant disability advocate. And he was, for a while, we were in Oklahoma at the same time, and he directed the center in Tulsa. And I remember him saying once to a group of deaf people who were saying that the Tulsa center at that time were telling Roland that they didn't provide services folks who were deaf needed. And Roland's response to that was, make me. And he didn't mean that as, I'm not going to do it, so you have to make me. He meant, we respond to the community, and if you show us that we need to be doing this, then we will do this. Now, there may be other CILs that are doing it without that community advocacy, but I think the point I'm trying to convey is if people are interested in working with other groups, then it's probably easier to facilitate that happen.
Gotcha.
And ironically, the question from the chat room is that Maddie, they're organizing their first disability pride parade or pride march. And they're wondering if you have ideas for resources for that, or if there's resources for chants that they could use.
I saw a couple of BART trains went by while you were saying that, and I missed if you said where this person is.
Sure.
Or this
they're in Cincinnati organizing their first Disability Pride March and wondering if there's a resource that they could use to come up with chants.
Yeah. Yes. So she was Cincinnati. So I would definitely get a hold of Chicago, if that's just living. Because they're the ones who have been doing it the longest on an annual basis. They weren't actually the first, but they're the first to be doing it on an annual basis.
Did that person ask a question?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
did that person that asked the question said because coming from the that there's she's trying to start a disability pride parade in Cincinnati?
Yeah.
Really? I want to help.
Oh, you guys are talking to me, right?
Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
This is the person who said something about the march in Cincinnati. My name is Kat Lyons, and I work at the Center for Independent Living Options, which is our IL center in Cincinnati. So if anybody
I work at IL in Northern Kentucky.
Okay. If you would like to contact me, please feel free. It's 241-2600, area code 513.
Okay.
And we have a committee working on 25th anniversary ADA event on Fountain Square, and this Disability Pride March is going to be part of that. So we welcome all of you to participate.
Thank you.
That's great. A couple things. I don't know if you're familiar with the ADA Legacy website, but you might look on there for some information. A lady named Kathy Wolf, KathiWolfe, wrote an article a few years ago. Actually, I think it's in the blog, one of the blogs that I put out this year. She wrote an article about Disability Pride Parade. So I know of ones in Chicago, San Jose, Philadelphia. Philadelphia's gotten kind of a big one. And I know there are others around. Those are the three that come right to mind.
Great. Thank you.
Oh, and I also had the opportunity to actually walk in one in Stockholm a few years ago. So they're actually happening all over the world then.
Great. Huh. Looks like we might have another caller. Claudia, I think. Claudia, did you have a question?
Well, yeah, I would like to hear Steve recite his Tell Your Story poem. I mean, I can read it just like anybody else can, but I just feel it's very powerful and would like to hear Steve recite it.
If there's time, I'd be happy to do that.
Were there any more callers that didn't get a chance to ask their question yet?
Yeah, hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
Hello? Oh,
yes.
Yeah. I hate to beat a dead horse here, but I had two things I wanted to point out about your definition for disability culture, and I just...
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I'm the only one, and I speak for myself only, but I feel like pride is probably the wrong word in all instances. You know, and to give you an example, you'll never hear anyone say, I'm proud of my son or daughter for being disabled. You may be proud of what they've accomplished after they become disabled, but even that sort of has a stigma that lowers the bar for people with disabilities. And I also think on the first guy that commented on this, where he said, you know, you're identifying us as people with disabilities instead of individuals who happen to have disabilities. And I just wanted to bring that up and see if anyone else agrees with me on both the wording for pride and the definition of a person with a disability.
This is Mike Levinson. I'm in San Francisco. I think the word pride is supposed to refer to the person, not to the disability. In other words, the person is proud of who they are, not proud of their disability. In other words, regardless of whether you're gay or straight or disabled or African-American or whatever the Pride March is about, it's that you're proud of yourself, what you've become, and what you represent, regardless of what other attributes you have.
And this is Terry in Texas, and I just want to just add a remark to that statement, that it's not about how others see you. It is definitely how you walk upon this world with your disability, being proud.
Well, again, I mean, I think you can be proud, but it seems odd to me. I think it's the same mistake that the gay pride parade makes. I understand that they're proud of who they are, but it seems like the wording could be better. It seems like there has to be a better way to say it, a clearer way. But I could be alone.
I wasn't saying anything, but you've heard what I have to say.
I guess this is
other people.
This is Mike again. I was muted. Let me say it a different way. In other words, if you are proud of yourself, it's not because you're proud of being disabled or overcoming a disability. It's saying that having a disability does not eliminate or reduce your personal self-esteem. You're still out there in the job market, or you're out there volunteering to help other people, or you're out there, you know, performing well in sports or whatever it is you're doing. You know, you're another person in the community of people and not a person restricted to your group of people with disabilities or your race or your sexual orientation. You're saying, I'm part of the whole world. I'm just a person that has this particular characteristic, but it doesn't stop me from being a full participant in the rest of the world. That's the pride that it represents.
I understand that, but like for wording, if you call something a disability pride parade, then it infers that we're proud of our disability. I understand what you're saying. Yeah. I just feel like the wording could be different or better. It's because people see that and it just...
So what would you change to get the point across that people with disabilities are trying to display the fact that they're everyday members of society just like everyone else? How would you reword that phrase so it's not like, you know, three sentences long?
Well, yeah, I think that therein lies the problem, but
right.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Lindsay. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, I'm from North Dakota, and I have a disability, and I'm proud of it because it's made me the person that I am today. Without my disability, I would not be as strong as I am, and I would have not met the people that I have met. But it is because of my disability that I am as strong as I am, and I have met the people that I have met, and it has made me the person that I am today. And I'm able to work with my disability.
Great. I feel like the conversation always livens up right at the end.
Yeah.
Are there, I know I want to be respectful of your time, Steve. You know, do you have time for maybe one more question, or?
I do. And I appreciate
it. Are there any more folks who didn't have a chance yet to speak their question? Maybe, would you mind maybe taking us out with a part of your poem?
I don't mind. So, so I'll read the first story. There's three stories in here. They're all true. And the first one, it's, well, anyway, I don't want to say any more about it. So Tell your story. Tell your story. It may bump from the page like words of Braille, sizzling in tales of blazing glory. It may glisten in the sunshine like the Holy Grail. So tell me a tale, even if it's gory. I'm yearning to hear you tell your story. Have you heard about the man in the motorized chair, found no ramp at the movie theater? Did he despair? No, just let them dudes lift him in there. Came back a few days later, after something greater. Brought with him a crew, people in chairs just grew and grew, said they knew they'd be part of the view. No problem getting in, just lift and push and move those hunks of tin. The chairs, they weighed a plenty. The ushers stressed and strained and got somewhat venty. Seeing the movie was not the goal. Changing the stage was the whole. They paid for getting in, but that theater knew its sin. People in chairs feel their own personal stamp on that theater's shimmering new wheelchair ramp. So that's one.
Wow, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
I just really, really appreciate you joining us today. I know the folks on the line do as well. And again, if you want to get a copy of the transcripts or the audio recording today, you can go to our website at april-rural.org. And I think that might be a wrap. Do you have any last thoughts, Steve?
I just wanted to thank everybody, including the behind-the-scenes people that you thanked earlier, and to say that the very last slide on the PowerPoint has my email address, which is bizculture@gmail.com if anyone wants to continue the conversation or ask questions, etc.
Great. Thank you again. And for folks, if you would like to go to our website, there is an evaluation link on the homepage along with the audio transcript. We appreciate any feedback that you have to give us. We're always trying to make things, better for the future. So thanks again.